You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Just before we get into the show today, just a reminder that I am on tour with my stand-up show Like I Mean It. Very excited about this one, and it is coming to a town near you if you are near certain towns in the UK. All the details at comedianscomedian.com/tour. Fill your boots.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. This is Stuart Goldsmith and this is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast, the only podcast about comedy. Today I'm talking to Beth Stelling live at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas. You will know Beth from her Netflix special. She was one of the six people in the first series of Netflix's The Stand-Ups. I urge you to check that series out. The second series as well is currently available with people like Gina Yashere, who you'll know from this show, and Nate Bargatze, a newer comic, newer to me at least, about whom I'm very excited. So you can see her stuff on Netflix. You can also find Beth's material on Spotify. There's some older albums, and she's someone who's very interesting to chart the development of her persona over the last few albums, right up to her newer work. I'm really excited to have her on the show. As you will hear from this episode, there were one or two walkouts. Don't be alarmed. It's a laminate-based festival, which means everyone has these laminates around their necks that let them get into anything for free. So it's one of those events where people try out various things. I walked out of numerous things myself, not walking out in anger, but, you know, you think you're expecting one thing, and then you go, oh, actually, This is a different meaning of the word theatre. This is all about surgery. Fine, and you leave. So there's one or two of those. I think we've probably edited out most of them, but I'm just flagging that up in case a couple of them sneak in under the radar. Nonetheless, I'm really pleased with this episode with the brilliant Beth Stelling. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I first saw you at the Punchline in San Francisco as part of Sketchfest a couple of years ago. Yeah,
really?
you were doing a doubleheader with Maeve Higgins. Yes.
Love her.
And it was great, really great show. And then I saw your, in preparation for this, I saw your Netflix special, the Heartfire special.
Did your homework.
Thank you. I'm very good on homework. And I felt like you were a whole other comedian.
That's good.
In a good way. Yeah.
No, that is a good thing, I think.
Do you feel like you've leveled up recently?
I think it's just such a long process. You know, I just did this, I go on tons of tangents, but it just made me think of something, which is, I write for the show Crashing on HBO. I wrote for season one and two. In season two, one of the guest stars is Wayne Fetterman. He is a comic and he's an actor. He had me come into his class because he teaches this, stand-up comedy class level two at USC. So he's like, will you come and speak at it? You know, they're really excited. They want to see it. And I was like, okay, cool. So it's college students that eventually want to be stand-ups. So I go in, and speaking of how I've changed or whatever, they're talking to me because they've seen the Netflix thing. That's kind of all they really know of me. You know, it was just the half hour on Netflix. But after we began talking, it was like questions they just had for me. A lot of more like, how do we get an agent? I'm like, slow down. You don't want anybody to see you like this. You know, at this level.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't want anybody to, like, because when you first start, you think, like, well, better get this on YouTube so people can start seeing my work. And you're like, yep. Horrible mistake. But anyway, I had them, my little homework for them after I left was just like, you should watch my very first Conan when I just moved to LA and I'm 26. And I didn't even know how to say how I wanted my hair. Do you know? I was like, how about we do it up? And I had to, like, I'm not like much of a crier, but I almost cried before I went out my first time because I looked like prom. It was like full on, like up here, and I was like, no, this is fine. This is what I could look like. Absolutely. This is my look, you know, and because I didn't even know how to say just when it comes to hair and makeup and stuff. So I was like, watch that, how I am there, and then watch the one I just did in November. I did my own hair, which could have been a mistake. And
but it was your mistake that you owned
but
and thought about.
But I was comfortable, and I could have probably worn something more fashionable, but I wore the thing I was most comfortable in, and I'm more me, you know, at least closer to my personality, I guess. But I was just saying, like, it's great and okay to change as a comic, and I have. I mean, I think I've changed a lot. However, my defense mechanism always is, like, if I'm nervous or if there's pressure on me, I'm always like very chill, you know, like in auditions they're like, excuse me, are you alive, you know, can we a little bit more, you know, because I think I'm just like, and a lot of people think I'm drunk or high because I'm just, I don't know, calm.
You are calm, and it's interesting seeing that on stage. Like, one of the notes I made watching the Netflix special was, I want to ask you, we maybe get to this, but
sorry, was that too long at the end? I'm very judgmental of myself. And that made sense, right? Like, that's how, it was like 2012 to, I'm used to like immediate feedback. I'm like, hell, does everybody love me?
I told you this would happen.
I know. Okay.
If you did one tangent for 60 minutes, we'd all be thrilled. It's fine. Don't worry about tangents.
I was cold and then I was hot. I was like, okay. But 2012 to, and then that was 2017. So that was 5 years. Anyway.
You have, I don't know what the correct terminology for it. Is it a drawl? You talk so kind of slowly and gently. It's not just calm. It's like, it's such a deliberate laid back quality that you have.
Okay. I don't know. I will say, because you know, people are like, what is your thing? What, you know, when you first start, they're like, well, what's your shtick? And people still kind of ask me that. And now I've eventually started answering. I'm like, I don't know. I talk about my life and my family, just stuff that happens to me. I don't know. Because if I were political, my answer would be like, I'm a political comic. Yes. So when it comes to like, what's your style? Initially, I relied on this. Oh, God. Initially, I relied on this. the first review that I got in Chicago after this Lincoln Lodge, and it was like, it was something like calm, dry, and acerbic or something like that. Okay. I was like, that's what I am. You know, you're just like clinging at things to figure out what you are, because I didn't start watching any stand-up. In fact, I avoided it all entirely. I was terrified of stealing. So I didn't watch any. I never wanted to be a comic because I was watching like X, Y, or Z. My heroes growing up were Robin Williams and Jim Carrey, and so it was like their acting and getting attention like that. So I don't know why it comes out of me the way it comes out of me. You know, like I just remember sitting down to write initially. That's how I used to sit down, was type it all out, and then you try not to make it sound like a monologue. But it just came out of me that way, and it came out of me when I first started, extra calm, extra slow, extra quiet. And I used to, the Chicago dudes, although I made many friends, would give me a hard time about being like, you whisper your punchlines.
And they gave you a hard time. Why? Because they,
because I would get up there and I was just like, but I will say everybody would listen.
Yeah, because that's a great system. Like, that's a really good way. In a rowdy room, you can see a comic have to shout over the crowd, and then someone much smarter will just move the mic further from their mouth and speak more quietly and get the focus.
Yeah, it ended up working to my advantage, yeah. That made me think of something, but then I forgot. Oh, yeah, just I was just kind of quiet initially. Yes. I think I would just sort of, and they would give me a hard time about being quiet, you know, because I always had this insecurity that I would never kill with my style.
Why?
Because I think, you know, like I said, some of my heroes especially were so big and animated. Mm-hmm. And I think I wanted to be like that. And I studied acting and I went to school for theater and I was very animated in my face. I did speech and debate as a high school kid. I was like one of the few women in the humorous category. And that's basically like a one-woman show. You play all the parts. It's called humorous interpretation. So you would be like, yeah, high school kid, like doing all these like facial things. So I started getting my laughs that way. It was like kind of like the first little taste into stand up. And then for whatever reason, like I said, it just came out of me like.
That's interesting, because I would have expected that the journey that most comics go on, I think, is often about trying to become more like yourself.
Yeah.
So I would have expected you to have started off more animated and then later realized that you could be closer to your own natural rhythm.
Yeah, or started out animated, not gotten laughs, and been like, better not do that again.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's like to take such a big risk if you're doing some sort of huge act out and then the joke bombs, you're like, I'm going to pull back in,
yeah.
You know, and I'm not going to take such a big risk with my body.
Is there a certain kind of comfort? Is there like a protection in that in the early days that if you are going slowly, you're not suggesting too much of a payoff?
Sure. Yeah, maybe that. And then on top of it, I think material wise, if you're talking slower, you go through less material.
Smart.
It's like changing your term paper to courier, you know?
I don't understand that local reference.
See what you're missing? Off the dome.
So that initial... Talk to me about some of the other lessons you remember learning in the first years of trying.
Oh, man. I mean, the pure pressure and fear that I had developed of some of my peers there. Like, even though we're fine now and stuff, there is like a... It's going to be sound too, like, sensitive or something, but, like, a bullying aspect. I mean, I continued on, but, like, where you're... I remember having to do some 24-hour fundraiser, and there's these two dudes that I started in Chicago with that were just very, like, you know, they knew everything. They could quote... They'd always be quoting comics that, like I said, I didn't know. And I'd just be like... Initially, I'd pretend. You know, they talk about, like, Andrew Dice Clay, or they talk about, like, Bill Hicks, and... They just talk about all these people that they idolize, and I'd be like, yeah, no, I love that one. But I would have no clue what they were talking about because I didn't want to know. And they also would give me such a hard time about, this sounds like I was like, mwah. We grew to be friends and everything, but I think there's a healthy amount of that. But they would give me a hard time for not doing open mics. Like, I... wouldn't do open mics. I would pretty much just do shows and like freaking test out my stuff there. Because I didn't want, my answer to that is those guys I'm talking about and other ones who I may not have known as well, why would I go up in front of them and be like, let me test this stuff out and be vulnerable in front of assholes?
Yeah.
Or people,
yeah,
knows them.
Gigs with low capacity.
Yeah,
few
why would I get
in, lots
yeah,
of comics
yeah? Because it's mostly an open mic is at a bar typically, and it's comics sitting around, and sometimes they'll laugh for each other. And if they have an alliance, I've just turned it into an MTV show. If they have an alliance, they're going to laugh at their buddy that went up, and they would never like this girl thinks she's funny. You know, like they grew to find me funny and
sure.
be supportive. But I think initially, like, why would I go up and be vulnerable to them and be like, "Do you guys think this is funny? I don't care if they think it's funny." At all. So I would just do my little show in Boys Town, which is a gay part of Chicago, with my best friends, the Butterboss Sisters. And we would be silly together, and we grew in that way together. We call it, we learned how to put our briefcases away, meaning we learned how to, like, just stop worrying about the set list, put away, get up there, and just be funny together.
Yeah, okay. I like the briefcases analogy. I often think of that as like flying with your head in the cockpit.
It's terrifying.
You're too busy looking at all the dials to actually fly.
Yeah, and I think that that's another part of it too. I still find myself married to a set list. Like, and it'll just be the difference for me in my head between fun and a good show and one where I'm more in my head, you know. But it varies on from show to show. What I will be committed to on a set list or something like that, you know, and how comfortable I am.
So do you think that that process of performing in proper, like presumably less frequently than if you were going out doing two or three open mics a mm-hmm. night, you learnt differently and you maybe learnt in such a way that it was more true to discovering yourself?
Yeah, that's possible, you know, because I don't know, I wasn't writing for them for one. And I didn't rely on what, yeah, like I said, I just think I was sort of like, when young comics would ask me, like, well, I'm scared to do it or I want to do it, my advice typically is, like, just do what you think is funny. That's the biggest reward. I remember watching some of, so there were a lot of comics I loved watching. I remember basically I moved to Chicago to do theater. I did one play, The Good Person of Szechuan, starring by Bertolt Brecht. It was in like a storefront theater, because there's a ton of great theater in Chicago, and then there's like a lot of storefront theater that no one's going to come to, and it's pretty bad, and you get paid like $100 for 17 weeks of work. And so I found myself with like a 22-year-old jaded theater actor, and I was like, well, I shouldn't be jaded at this age. And that's when I took it into my own hands and started writing my own stand-up and stuff. And then I started sort of casing the joint, meaning I would go to Chicago shows and be like, well, what is this all about? What is stand-up about? Because I wanted to do it. And I knew I wanted to do it probably since I was like 18. So then I start watching people, and I'm sure if comics are listening or in the audience, they did the same thing. You're in the city you're in, you're like, okay, I know I want to do it, so I'm going to go to an open mic, maybe I'll watch, and I'm just definitely going to sit there because I can't sign up. That's terrifying. And then you start going to shows, and you have these moments where you're like, I'm better than that guy.
Yeah, totally. I was going to say, that's
you're like, well, if he's up there talking about his dick, I can get up there, you know, and not talk about my dick. You know, and then there'll be people, I remember like Sean Flannery, and I was like, oh, I can't do that. Because I was like, he is so good. And he is a great comic. And then people like Prescott Tolk, who basically I remember watching them and thinking, the joy that I found, you know, basically as a comic, the longer you go, you can still be laugh. If you find a new comic that you've never heard and they make you laugh, like what a joy, you know, like, oh my God, I am still alive. You know, I can still feel, I can still be tricked. But, another comic you'd watch and you may respect them and know they're funny, and the way you laugh at their jokes is like, that's good. Or I wish I thought of that. I was watching Anna Sarajina in LA. We did a show together a couple weeks ago, and she has this bit, which obviously I don't want to like put on blast here, but it was very funny. She has a thing where she was able to, I don't know, I don't want to tell her joke, but it's along like her scarf was like, you know, she's like sings a song to describe a scarf. And I was like, I wish I wrote that. Like, so I'm not laughing, but I'm like, that was great.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think eventually the joy of what I'm finally coming around to is when young comics are like, what do I want to do? You say, write what you think is funny. But what that ends up creating, the biggest reward is if I'm writing what I think's funny and it's so unique to my brain, and then five people, okay, if everybody laughs, wow, okay, great. But if like seven people laugh, you're like, wow. So yes. They also know what I know, or they also know what I saw. And those can be just as fun laughs too. Like I have this joke right now where I say to the last guy I had sex with, it was so bad, it felt like fucking a rectangle. And it'll hit with maybe like, I don't know, 40, 60, 20, 80. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
That resonated with the people it needed to resonate with.
Yeah. How do you, I love it, and I remember that joke from last night.
Yeah.
It's a lovely joke, and particularly it's a lovely joke in the context of, it's quite an unusual joke for you, for what you've set up on stage. It's quite, you know, you're dry, acerbic, as we've learned.
But dark.
You're dry, dark, and acerbic. But that one, that's my friend Alfie refers to that as throwing in a dafty. Like, do you know what I mean? You just chuck something in, makes you laugh. And that,
yes.
You know. And so talk to me about then the development of that audience, because I think something I fell prey to in the early days of my comedy career was, well, two things in particular. One, I had this idea in my head of what a comedian should be, and then I tried to do an impression of that.
Sure.
I think a lot of people end up doing that. It sounds like you completely avoided that.
Somehow, because like I said, really it was fear-driven. You know, like I've grown to love and know, and now I watch, of course, and I think you can see probably who I have been inspired by, or people I've ended up touring with, or something who I idolize. I mean, like I jock Sarah Silverman style all the time. You know, I toured with her all last year. I adore her. She, you know. So I think eventually I did start being open to watching without fear of like stealing, you know, but even still, I still have that in my head. If I'm out watching a ton of comedy and I'm like, oh, what if I wanted to do a premise on that? It would be my deepest fear to have someone think I stole something from them.
Yeah, cool.
I was around Brooklyn. So writing on the show this summer, last summer, that means I also get to do stand up in New York, as long as I'm not tired from the days. But there was a young comic that I did her show in the middle of nowhere, Brooklyn. She did she goes up before me, and it's a joke like pretty similar to mine, but obviously I think mine's better. Okay, that was mean. I didn't mean it like that. I just meant like you're like, no, but I like the way I do it. So I had to talk to her afterwards, and I rarely have to do that. I was like, just so you know, I would hate it if you see me do a joke later, because I might have a bigger reach, or you see me, And you would think that I took that from you. So I just want to let you know, I do have a joke that's similar to that. And then I ended up getting her on the show because I felt really bad because I didn't want to, you know, she plays a comic on the show.
That is exactly how you should deal with that situation. Like, it's like, just so you know, let's put a pin in this.
My joke's better than yours, but I will get you on HBO.
Great.
That helps.
If only every comic worked like that. Yeah. Every time you see a famous comic and you think, hang on, that's familiar. If you go, no, it's fine. They didn't just pay them off.
Yes.
They got them an opportunity. Yeah. That's what made me look.
But I'm sure the truth is she could still do her joke and I could still do mine. But I forget, did I even answer your question?
Well, the second part of my question was that of those two, I was saying there's two things I particularly remember falling prey to. One was doing an impression of what I thought a comic should be like. And the other was wanting to get everyone in the room laughing. Now, that's important.
Right, right.
But in the early days of your career, I think, as you identified, it's more important to make people who are going to like what you do and, you know, people who are going to become super fans.
Yes.
You get them rather than be like, well, everyone in the room thinks I'm quite good.
Right, because then, yeah, I know. Yes, so I know exactly what you're saying. And I think I've always been able to, since I started... Well, I have been able to do both comedy clubs and all rooms, which I don't know exactly how I've done that. I think I can maneuver in between because I do write jokes, but I also can still go into an alt room, which I don't know if we need to describe that.
Yeah, please.
Like a comedy club would be, so say where I started, you know, in Chicago, Zany's Comedy Club, very sort of rigid and strict, like before you even get to go on.
A commercial comedy club.
Yeah, before you get to go on, you literally have to sit through a speech from the owner about like the rules and what it means and where you start. And you typically start as a host and you work your way to feature, which is the middle act. And then maybe, if you're lucky, you would be a headliner. But I actually ended up skipping straight to feature because he viewed me as a character. Like, he didn't think I could get up and be like, hey, everybody, so who's having a birthday? See those cards on your table? Fill them out! You know what I mean? And he was right. Because I'd be like, hey, welcome to the show. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Which is
so
a great way of
like
avoiding that work.
Myself. That pretty much ended up benefiting me, too. So then I get in at the club, and you do need to have, like, jokes. And then an alt room, which is pretty much the rest of the city in a way. Like my show was in a dive bar called Town Hall Pub. It was, people would call it the only straight bar in Boys Town, but that's just because it was like not nice. It was carpeted and it looked like your grandmother's basement. But you could still like go in there, and then of course gay people were absolutely there and welcome, but they called it the straight bar because it was nasty.
That's fair.
Yeah, so then you have that venue, and then you have mostly bar shows all around Chicago. So you could kind of call that definitely the alt, meaning alternative to a comedy club. You know, you don't have to 2-drink minimum. You don't have to go in, and it's not like here we are at a show, and it's more do it yourself. And so in those rooms, you want to sort of, they'd rather you, instead of like get up and be presentational, they want it to feel sort of like, we're just talking. I'm just coming up with this right now.
Sure.
Let me see. Let me tell you about my day. You know, and then you work your jokes in.
Yeah.
So I think there's a finesse to them.
Did they, as I understand it, those rooms value originality over like blanket.
Yeah. And you can watch someone who might be funny and good go up and bomb if they were just like, here's what I like. This is the next joke. This joke. You know, it might just be lost on them because they wanted to have a more relaxed vibe or something like that. Did I still not answer the question?
No, you did. You absolutely did. So what was do you remember the first bit, the first substantial bit where you felt like, oh, this is me. This is it. This is what I'm supposed to be following this direction.
Yeah, I would guess. Sorry, I'm smiling because I'm thinking of old videos of myself from Chicago and they're really upsetting to watch. It's like,
why? Because...
Yeah, it's actually making me gag a little. if you watch the videos, they're just like kind of put on, and I don't know how to describe it.
No,
sorry.
This is really important because I feel like I know the territory.
Yeah, I wish we could watch one right now and barf together, but...
Well, if you care to name one, if it's available on YouTube then listeners can...
No, I mean,
Oh, yeah, okay, you're
I up. Have it on DVD.
Don't put it on YouTube.
Yeah. Oh, no, it is on YouTube.
Okay.
Because I told you that mistake, and... It's just to private.
Okay.
So I could send you the link.
Send me the link, it's and then listeners upsetting. Of this show only can yeah. watch you be bad.
But the truth is, I could now even go back and kind of rewrite some of those to actually work for myself now. But I think then, yeah, they were just sort of like, they're just more put on. And it is kind of the Courier vibe, where you're just like, come on, babe, let's pick it up. You know, like a little too, making a meal out of a sentence. You know, I think now I do value a bit more. I value word economy. And even though I still am laid back and slow, I do like jokes per minute, you know. Yeah, so this was like, I guess the first bit that I can remember where I was like, this is my bit, would be the story of Wet n' Wild Water Park, where the punchline is. Okay, let me explain. It was like the first water park. We would go down, and I still worked in some of these jokes, by the way, but the old joke is, and I think it's on my first album, although whenever I look back at some of my old work, I'm like, please don't listen to that. Basically, I say my sisters and I would go down to visit. My parents were divorced. My sisters and I would go down to Orlando visit my dad because it was court ordered. And he would take us to this water park called Wet n' Wild. And I talk about all of us going down this slide as a family. And my sister went down and her top flew up. I mean, this is all real. But I was like really putting it on, you know, her top flew up. I can't remember all these punchlines, but, and then my dad goes on, he started with shorts. He ends up with a thong, you know, like, and then I went down and I basically, I lost my virginity. so then I say, they Dare Stuka, I think they should name it. I just douched ya. Yeah. I apologize.
What element of that did, do you remember what element of that felt like? Like, what was the reason that you went, hang on, this is the right
I think because it felt like my strongest bit. Like, it was long, it was strong, and it was down to get the friction on. Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize. It felt like an anchor, you know, a pillar of a set. So, yes. Like, if in your mind, you know, you're like, well, I start with this pillar and then I'll just somehow make it to the next one. And then I'll somehow make it to the next. So it felt strong and it always got laughs.
But do you have a sense now of why that was, why it felt so strong? Because I think for looking at it from the outside, we might say, oh, the reason that works is that resonates with like an honesty of like, we can smell that you're being your real self in that.
Sure.
And it, you know, the material there is... Smell was a bad example.
No, I don't even know. I was kind of just trying to figure it out while you were talking.
Well, what I mean is, I think when a comic finds their voice, in inverted commas, in air quotes, when someone finds their voice, I think you part of that process for an audience is that we go, this is true. This isn't just a person saying things that they think will make us laugh.
True.
There's some note of truth here that we go, this is them. This is real.
Yes. And I think that was always very important to me. I remember... I can pick out maybe one or two times where it has happened to like a friend of mine and then I wrote the punchline and it felt wrong. And she's like one of my best friends.
Okay.
So it was like the joke was, it's on an album somewhere, but basically she was riding her bike and some guy on a curb leaned over to her and he goes, sex, you know, like that. And then she just told me that story. And then I wrote the joke where I just say, no. You know, it was really more of a song that we created together. It's hard to write away from somebody when you collaborate like that. You know what I mean? So like that was the joke. I just fucked it up. But when you collaborate like that, that was the joke. So everything was true. And when it wasn't true, I could pick it out. And it bothered me. Like,
yes.
So I think that is the point. It was like family based and also a story, I would say. Because I also, then there were those fears too, that I would become like a storytelling comic. And I didn't want to just be that. Because I was like, can I write jokes? You know, if I'm getting my biggest laughs on a story, beginning, middle, and end, you know. But also, that was my first intro to somebody coming after me for stealing. Somebody came and said something like, this is a... And then they named some Midwestern comics bit. He has a joke about this water slide being a mile-long enema. And I don't know how they got in touch with me back then. It was probably like Facebook or something. But it was something like, you stole this. I mean, obviously that crushed me because I was like, no, I didn't. But then it made me feel safe too because I was like, I don't know who Brett whatever is. Like, well, how would I come in contact with him? Mm-hmm. That was like I said, one of my biggest fears. And so I think that is the first time that someone like accused me because stealing is like a weird fear of mine, you know?
So this is Beth. I really urge you to check out her stuff online. No better place to start than with that recent Netflix special. And she just has such a command of the stage. One of the things I love is how kind of rich and flavorful her comic voice is. She affects this wonderful, laid-back and high status, and it's just an incredibly rich kind of voice. So I really urge you to listen to her stuff. Now, as I have mentioned in previous episodes, in the last few at least, there has never been a better time to become a regular subscriber. Thank you to those of you who've been getting on board with that. Big announcement coming soon regarding subscription payments to the podcast, be they via Moonclerk, Patreon, or indeed PayPal. You can at the moment still do one-off donations, but I'm considering removing that option because actually I'm much happier when people kind of join the club, and hopefully there's going to be lots of stuff on the way. I've said too much. It's a good time to join. I don't want to overpromise, but there is a real concrete thing happening soon, so look forward to that. Also, a lovely bit of correspondence. I just want to say thank you to Robert Hone for, and I'm sure I'm mincing the pronunciation of your surname there, Hone, Hoon or Heen, H-O-E-H-N. How are you supposed to pronounce that? He took me to Paris recently, just done some lovely gigs in Paris for French Fried Comedy. Thanks to everyone that came along to that show, and in particular, thank you to Aaron and Lachlan and Carlia, who came en masse from Ecole Philippe Goliot. And I hope they took back with them a little bit of light in the constant painful darkness of clowning. So, yes, they had a fantastic time in Paris, and I'll tell you a little bit more about how that show went down later after the episode. But for now, let's get back to the sensational Beth Stelling.
Dan Soder and I were headlining Zany Chicago, not co-headlining to be confused with that, but he did it's kind of odd for a comedy club to do this, but I took all the early shows and headlined them and with the same host and feature, and he took all the late shows and headlined them, which works out great because you get to do one show a night and that's kind of like a gift. But we were talking about this, and since we were both on the stand-ups, the Netflix show, and more people have for sure were able to find us and then are coming out to see us at comedy clubs, you know, to see the rest of our material or our new hour or whatever. And we were just describing it as, it feels great to have people who come out and carry the crowd, do you know what I mean? Who are like, who get you, who are your fan, who are like, no, because I can see your face and it like makes me feel good, you know? And so now when you have more of that all around, it'll bleed into the other people who are like, yeah, maybe I can be on board for the next part, you know, or whatever it is. And Dan was describing it basically as drops in a bucket. You know, like that's what your career is, unless you skyrocket into something, like you become some sort of Vine star or you get on a hit show. Because we've seen that happen with our friends, too.
Sure.
Even with something like, what is it? Like maybe Daily Show, like Hasan Minhaj or something like that. We all started together in L.A. and that like skyrocketed him. So, and he's ready for it. He did a great mm-hmm. hour, but point being, typically it would be, you know, like drops in a bucket. You're gaining your crowd over time, and it's very rewarding. But it's also kind of like it works for me because I'm a patient person, and I don't. My goals when I started were I want to make money being funny, and I don't mean like I just mean like I don't want to make another bagel sandwich. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like I just want to be funny. And well, I just want to make fun
on the subject of
make a living.
Succeeding on the subject of victory. One of your jokes in your most recent album on Spotify, which I love, it's my favorite joke on the album, was you were talking about encountering someone that you used to go to school with in a donut shop. And just the end of that, which I will slightly spoil the end of it if that's okay by talking about it. One of the things that I really jumped out at me is like, oh, that's pure Stelling right there. Is you say at the end of that, what's the line at the end of the routine? I don't want to murder it. Could you? It's you're talking.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
About how the hockey thing.
Yeah, we basically, it was kind of like winning that district championship all over again.
Yeah, and what I love about that, the setup is you encounter someone at school and someone formerly at school in a donut shop. She used to bully you or whatever. You know, there was that kind of
previous. She was our rival team, basically, a nearby school, and they really did hate me. I mean, I was the team captain, and I definitely ruined their lives with my stick skills. But, yeah, they wrote spray painted number 10. Number 10 sucks. But I mean, I obviously, guys, I didn't suck.
But what I love about it is that that joke, I think it deceives the structure of that joke is that I listened to it imagining that you were going to say that made it up for all those times they beat us at hockey. And then at the last minute, it's like you not only won the encounter in the donut shop, but you also used to thrash them at hockey. And that contained like a really pure note in it that I was like, oh yeah, that's great. I really like that.
I'm glad.
That's not a question.
But is real. That girl, sometimes like I will make jokes like that and then I feel bad because it's basically saying like, if you work in food service, you know what I mean? But I worked in food service forever, and so it's not one of those things. It's just a matter of genuinely her and her teammates were fucking mean to me, and they were nasty on the field, and then now she has to give me jelly donuts whenever I want. I'm sure I can't go back at this point because I don't know if she heard it, but I don't think I may have a safe donut to eat ever again. I worry about that with the TSA as well. I'm like, I wonder if they will fuck with me now, especially if any of them. But I also look like such garbage when I fly. I hope that they just don't recognize me.
I want to talk about some of the effects. I'm not going to bounce off that into a thing about you looking like garbage. Where can I go as an interviewer with that?
I just mean like, yeah, who cares?
Given your more recent success, that there are now more drops in the bucket.
Yeah, does not that, a ton, but at least one.
Does that change the way you walk out on stage? Does it change your confidence in the room? You were talking about that effect of like, you know.
It helps for sure because sometimes you can dread going on the road in a comedy club because it can just be people who don't know who you are, and you come out, and if they don't know your style or if they're not expecting or they expect a certain night and then it's you, they're going to be very disappointed, and it's not going to be fun for you either. So if people are coming out that already have an idea of what they're going to get, that can only make my experience more fun. You know, and I can tell right away because if I just say one little line at the top and people like erupt, I'm like, thank God you're here, you know? And I have saves for it, you know? Like, if you guys don't know who I am, like, I usually come out to, like, a Dr. Dre song that's really big, and then I say I do that because then I come out, and it's such a stark contrast because I'm, like, the Sarah McLachlan of stand-up comedy. And so then if people like kind of laugh at that, I'm like, okay, well, then they're on board. But otherwise, if a dude's there to see someone, going back to what we said earlier, that's really big and animated and like, crush, 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 I feel inadequate. And I feel like, you know, like I will never kill like that because I'm not huge and, you know, do tons of act outs. And I'm more like, I like, someone reviewed me once and said it felt like I was talking to my best friend, like a conversation. And I like that.
What elements do you think that, like, some of your kind of superpowers are that, you know, the way you use language, the relationship you have with the audience? What elements of your comedy practice are there that you wish you were better at?
I can sometimes crowd work will go well for me, like if it's just natural and I feel comfortable and stuff. But other times, I would say I could go out of my way to do crowd work to get better at it. So if it needs to happen, it'll happen. It's usually if I have to kick somebody out. And And because people, you also just kind of have to learn that, you know, because people, as you see online, people find these heckler videos to be like, so they're always blown away by them. You know, when like this comic defeats heckler.
Comedian destroys so-and-so. And then you watch the video and it's actually just, yeah, I don't like you.
Right.
You
know, well destroyed. I know, and often they're not like that. It's because they're often not captured, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
But the truth is, it feels so powerful in the room to those people that were there. Because all you have to do to really win is just say the first thing that comes to your mind, you know, and the crowd will be sort of impressed because you have the mic. But yeah, you just gotta kind of come up with the first thing that comes to your mind. What was the question?
I was talking about the difference in how you perform now that there are fans in the room.
Okay, yeah, I'm more comfortable, like for sure. It just makes my time better. And then in my own mind, I can get a little worried, like, oh, don't get too comfortable. Because you had to work so hard to win some of those people over. And I might have a view in my head of people who don't like me, and they might like me, you know? Like, and I was shocked in Denver. I had this group of, like, bikers that came out that were fans, like bikers with tattooed heads, you know? And I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting, you know? And they sat in the front row and were like super amped. I did end up having to kick out his wife because she got so she got so drunk, yeah, that she stood up and fell over in front of the crowd. And then I had to like sing. I had to sing.
You had to sing?
Yeah, just to get, while they led her out, I sang a Sarah McLachlan song. Well, they got her out safely. But yeah, it's easier. And so then I worry that I'm not working as hard because it's, but I'm not in that place. Sometimes that's the fear of comics. If you, you know, blow up too much and then everybody that comes at you is just kind of hanging on your every word, you know, which is, I'm not saying that's where I am. I'm saying when you have such a huge fan base that then you lose your discerning quality, you know, like, where a crowd will kind of laugh at anything and you get away with having these soft jokes when really you need to craft something that's stronger. You know, you'd almost need to go someplace where nobody knows you to get a real, you know. So I'm enjoying the extra that I'm given, you know, because I can get away off of my charisma and charm if a joke doesn't totally hit. But
let's talk a little bit about the craft then. Whereabouts are you in the life of the material that you were doing last night in Esther's Follies?
Yes.
So the bit, the particular bit that stuck out for me last night was the koala care.
Oh, right, right, right. I think that I am in a place where I've been in like an on again, off again relationship. And so I've been dealing with what it feels like to be single again for the first time. And so that's been with it since probably October,
okay.
Feeling what it feels like to actually have to put yourself out there again. And I was constantly in a relationship with not the same person, but different people. I have a joke about it in an old special where I say I'm a Tarzan dater. Like before I let go of one dick, I'm just like swinging in the next dick. You know? So there's really only a brief period of time where you can catch me without a dick in my hand. So anyway, but that's not even, you know, but the truth is like, it's someone I know and I've known very well. So I'm very comfortable dating people that I've known. And now to put myself back out there, I'm starting to write jokes now within the last year that I find to be sexual. And I really avoided that when I first started. Because
okay.
I went to some of those open mics around Chicago and I would watch girls get up. And we were still in the minority. You know, there weren't as many girls. And they would sort of get up and be just, instead of necessarily funny, it would be more graphically sexual. Like, along the lines of like, you know, getting fucked in the butt and there was like poop everywhere. And you're just like, what is happening? It was offensive.
And that's the only two that's available.
And so, you know, you see someone talking about super graphic sexual things with no punchline and it felt like, oh no, this is not what I want for my gender. And so I, as a 22-year-old, when I started, I was like, I'm not going to be like really graphically sexual. I don't want to make women look bad. I really did kind of take on this, I'm representing women. As comics in Chicago. And I really was, in a way, because I was always the only female on the lineup for years. And more people started fluxing in. But like, that doesn't mean I was the only female comic in Chicago by any means. It just meant that there was like 7 shows going on, so we were all on the job, you know? So like, you know, I'm trying to think of like, the Putterbaz might be on a show over here, Cameron might be on a show over here, you know, but we weren't often on the same lineup because there was just few of us. So I did feel that sort of like I got to represent as well. And I don't want to be up here just talking about getting railed. So now that I'm 32, yeah. I think that I've been doing it for, what, now 10-ish years or something. I am allowing myself to talk about sex. So I like to think I do it in a creative way. But I'm finding myself doing it more, and I'm very judgmental of myself on it. Like, it's been hard for me to be like, shit, if people come and see me, if anything, I'm just like some gross comic that only talks about sex stuff. Because I'm very judgmental of myself. I just did the Dayton Funny Bone in February, which is my hometown in Ohio. And my grandma came out and surprised me, and she's 98. And I was just talking about sex stuff, and I was like, no. So I had to address the situation. I was like, my mom was worried. She was like, are you going to talk about graphic sex things? And I said that in front of everybody, of course, because my mom was worried pre-show. And I was like, Mom, you know, grandma's had it, you know, like, we don't want to think about it, but we don't want to think about what kind of sex it was, but it was the kind that worked because you're here. And then my grandma laughs, you know, and then I tell the story of, so I connected her into things, but because it's my hometown, I also had my best friend's parents in the front row. And at one point I just leaned down and I hugged him. I'm like, I'm so sorry, you know? And she emailed me later, my best friend's mom, and was like, we learned a lot. I mean, I have the email somewhere, but it's long and supportive, but it was just like, yeah, essentially that. So now I think I'm talking, my material is more that, because I'm not having sex, but I'm thinking about it. I'm dipping a toe in the idea of having sex with someone I haven't known for years. It's not going to happen, but that is where my mind is, where I'm just like, would I date again? I don't know.
And when you are doing shows from show to show, do you ever record the material and listen back to it? Do you,
yes.
How do you, is that one of your methods?
Yes.
Talk me through it.
Yeah, I record every single show I do. Yeah. And then I usually watch it for time too while I'm up there, so I know how long I've been going. But I listen more than some comics just record everything and never listen.
And
to
never
it.
Listen. Yeah, that comes
and
up
I
a
did
lot.
That for years, and I have hundreds and hundreds of recordings that I've never listened to.
Yeah.
But I do, especially if I'm at a club on the road. My homework for the next day is to listen to my set from the night before, and that is sometimes good and sometimes bad, because like even just in Zany's last week, and I listened to my Friday night set, which I was having so much fun, and it was like I was very loose and I was like riffing, and then if I listen to myself be like that, I'm like, how do we do it again, you know? And then if you try to put structure on something that is just you free-flowing and being yourself, I end up having a worse show on Saturday night. And I'm a perfectionist, so worse is fine, but it's not good enough.
What's fine, but it's not good enough, did you say?
The show wasn't good enough.
Oh,
but I'm sure people had fun.
Sure.
Yeah.
So,
like, they laughed and stuff, but...
So when you're...
it's nothing like this, but yeah.
So when you're, like, what environment is that in? Are you listening back to it sat in front of a computer? Are you walking around? What's your...
In my hotel room on the bed, usually up again, yeah, propped up for some lumbar support. And, yeah, press play, have my notebook out, and then I'm writing down the way it worked the best.
And how is that psychologically when you're listening back to a tougher show? Is it more useful if the show was tougher?
You know what? Sometimes I don't listen to the tough ones, but... I also do to remind myself that I'm a psycho and it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like I should listen to my show from last night. I got off stage and I was like, yeah, man, you were really not in it. You know, because at one point on stage, I was like, sorry, I just fell asleep. You know, because I did. Yeah, I was just like, because
I wondered if that was a bit. It was so funny. Your recovery from that was so funny. I was like, oh, that's the falling asleep bit.
Yeah. No, I think sometimes I just get in my head and I'm judgmental. And so, yeah, sometimes I need to listen to it to be like, you need to calm down. They were laughing. It wasn't as bad as you thought. So
absolutely.
I have done that.
I find sometimes I listen back to ones that I have the inverse problem. I listen back to ones going, well, I smashed that. So this is going to be great. And you listen back and I don't think it was as good as I thought it was
at
the time.
Yeah, because you can't always remember, especially doing a 45-minute set. Can't always remember everything that hit. But also sometimes I'll improvise something and then I'll have it recorded so I can remember to put it back in.
Yeah.
Put it in new.
If it's okay to take some questions from the audience,
from the ones that are left have earned it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Your loyalty has earned you some questions.
I really wish when the lights came up, though, it was just my gal.
Yeah.
No, but I do appreciate everybody who stayed.
But while people think of questions, what do you want out of comedy? What will satisfy you?
I feel like, you know, maybe it sounds like, I don't know if this sounds believable or not, but like I am doing it. Like I said, I think there's always, I've always set goals, especially when I first started, and those goals were just like, perform at Lakeshore Theater, you know, or perform, someday I'll get to do this, someday I'll feature. So like, I think I had a lot of those goals initially, and I have my lists like somewhere at home, and it'll be like, be on the Tonight Show, or, you know, this or that. And those have changed because as you grow, you realize like, oh, some comics just aren't right for this particular talk show and some of them are better. And then David went off the air, but, you know, so you kind of change and adjust. But now I will say I have met that goal of I get to be a full-time comedian. So I do feel happy and like that I am living it. What was the question?
What will satisfy that was it, you in right? comedy? What do you want from comedy?
Yeah, so I think I am satisfied, but I also think I like to continue to grow my people that come out. I think success kind of scares me because I already kind of said that. Whereas like if everybody in the crowd already likes me and I don't have to work for it, then am I really funny? You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes any sense. Like, so, it's just a full thing of people who love you and no one hates you. No one's unhappy to be there.
Then that's a sign of failure somehow.
I don't know what I'm talking about. Maybe I think I'm just a little bit scared of, yeah, I don't have these dreams of not being able to, who would, not being able to go places. But I just think like I don't crave fame. I crave like people coming out and I get to laugh and perform on a good show and we feel good together because I was able, not everybody wants to talk into a mic and say things. So if I can do it for us, well, won't that be fun? You know, like basically I've said this before in an interview, but like when I say something weird or something that was to me or something I've been through in my life and people are laughing, then we get to do it together. They're basically saying like, ha, me too. You know, like that's what they're saying is me too, or at least I get it, you know? So that's like, that's my pure joy is that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And a question over there.
Yeah, I think so.
Can you put the question into your answer?
Sure. Basically, the question was, I started more deadpan and have I grown more into myself? Because like, yeah, and I was a theater person and all this jazz. I was theatery in my actor world and then I go into stand up and I'm very deadpan. I will say my first, like, an evening with at Nerdmelt in LA was probably the first time, and I don't know when that was, maybe 2013, I don't know, where I remember very clearly going, wow, that's the closest I have been to myself. It was my hour at Nerdmelt, which is a comic book store in LA. So it took a long time. I started in 2007, so it took like to 2013 for me to be like, oh, I'm closest to myself on stage and more animated and
drawing more on your theatrical experience.
Yes, yeah, more facial expressions and, yeah, feeling more comfortable to probably do that.
Question is about what you said about not wanting to be a storyteller, not feeling that that was enough or a high enough
right.
level to
I think
to
that's something
to.
Put on, like, there's so many pressures that are put on by comics. They spread things among each other, like, you got to get up 5 times a night or you're not a real comic, or, you know, if you don't do late night or if you don't get this or that, you know, or even when I did the half hour, it's like, ooh, because an hour is like an hour is more prestige, you know? So it's like to only do a half would be like, are you not good enough to do an hour? So like there's all these things that we like put on each other. Each year you come up with a new hour, you know? So I think storytelling, if you're just that, maybe that's just another little thing that goes around comics. Like, well, you just do stories though. Can you write a joke? And so I think that's maybe where that came from. But the truth is, like, in Chicago, I did The Moth, and that was one of my greatest memories, is doing The Moth. I told this story about my dad feeding raccoons. He feeds, like, 79 raccoons.
I remember that story from San Francisco. Yeah.
And so that is one of my greatest experiences. So it's not that storytelling's easy. It's not that it's not jokes. Because to me, sometimes my stories, like the Wet and Wild one, that was my first feeling of like, okay, like I can do this. I can make people laugh. And that's just a story with jokes along the way, you know? it's a miniature version of a full set when I was describing like the pillars of getting you in between things. So I don't look down on storytelling. Sometimes it just feels like it could be a separate thing, or it's almost safer, you know, because you have a beginning, middle, and an end, and you are saying a story, whereas a joke just feels riskier. It's shorter and...
Yeah, the jeopardy is greater for you, so yeah. You feel that's more of a success to have achieved.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe that's what it is. But yeah, I don't look down at storytelling, and I still have a lot of stories in my act. And I think that it is important to incorporate them actually into your stories, into your... in my new hour, like, I'll have a couple. I always have a couple of stories, like, from my real life and everything like that. Because it connects you to the people, because you're telling something that actually happened to you.
And are there stories from your life that you are waiting to tell until you have even more skill?
Yes.
Intriguing. Thank you. That's a fantastic question. I'm going to ask you to ask it again, because I'm not going to be able to do it justice.
I was saying, when you said that you didn't feel like you had to be a representative of women in the industry anymore, was it something in the industry that changed, or was it something that clicked in you that changed?
Yeah. I think over time, being in the industry, you know, like, so now I was able to go from Chicago, where it grew from like two other female comics that I knew. I joke about making a distinction, but for this question, I will say female comic. Knowing two to seven to, you know, like, and there were women who, right, I didn't mention this, but I went to an all-female showcase before I started it in Chicago. It was all females. There was like seven of them. They were great, but they all left. It was their showcase before they moved to LA. So if people are listening, like, how were there only two? That's what I mean. Like, there was a mass exodus of women leaving, so we kind of had to build up. And there was tons of women in improv. But when it came to stand-up and me feeling like a representative, I think it changed over time, because I eventually left Chicago to a place where there were even more female comics. And my perception, although it still happens in LA, I remember going in my early years of LA and going to a show and there were no women on it. And I wouldn't have even questioned it if I were on it. Because if I'm on, I'm like, oh, we're good. But I noticed that there was just all men, and I was like, this feels weird. But I wouldn't have felt weird if it was I was on it, and I'm only one. So I think over time there are more women, and there just are definitely in LA more female comics, for sure. So there's more representation, so that changes in my mind. And there are also so many of us who are different. And I will say in LA, and they're not being billed this way, I have done, in the last 2 months, I think at least 3 or 4 all-female showcases in LA, and they're not billed as like the ha-ha hotties. You know what I mean? It's actually just a show, and it was bonkers. I mean, I'm not just saying that like, wow, women are funny. That's what it sounds like I'm saying. But I was just like, this is incredible and inspiring, and I hadn't heard of some of these women, like Takeda Love, and like, and I know Suba Argwal, and but there was like, Helen Hong, we were all on the show together at improv, and I was like blown away. I was like, this is cool, because I'm not even thinking about us all being female, and I don't think the crowd is either. And we're all so different. So that's what I think so I don't know, I guess the industry has changed. And I've changed because I've seen all these women around me who have changed me.
Thank you. Great question. Great answer. Last question over there, and please let's make it something really fantastic, so that very last person that left with 2 minutes to go can frankly go fuck themselves, sir. Following on from the success of Jim Carrey and Robin Williams in going into movies, is that something you're interested in doing, or is stand-up for its own sake enough?
Yes, it is definitely something, because it kind of almost perfectly... and I've done a little TV acting too this year that I always find joy in. You know, it's fun, especially when I've gotten to work with people who I know. That makes it the best, because they know what to expect from you. But when it comes to film, I am already set to do a couple just like fun indie films with people like Sean Patton, who's here. We're set to do something together in the summer. And so it's like, you know, it doesn't mean it's like some sort of huge blockbuster hit, but like it is something I'm excited about, is to sort of be on screen and do movies. However, thinking about loving Jim Carrey and Robin Williams, and knowing what I know, having worked on TV shows now and been on set, can you imagine being so talented and with such a vision that you show up and you're Ace Ventura? this blows my mind that anybody, because I can show up and make like a choice. It's like, meow, you know what I mean? But to be like, somebody stop me, you know? Can you imagine bringing that, like the balls that it takes, like to, or use whatever, fallopian tube? It takes to show up and be that. I mean, the vulnerability, the silliness, I'm still in awe. So like, I do want to be in movies, but like, man, it would take a lot for me to be like my heroes. You know what I mean? And I do have female heroes if anybody's judging me.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we've got time for. Please join me in thanking Beth Stelling.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
So that was Beth. Thank you very much to Beth. Thanks, as ever, to Charlie Sotelo and Kelly and everyone at South by Southwest who made that possible. Thank you to Nathan Wood for his excellent editing and production skills. And thank you to you for listening. Thanks for supporting the show and in whatever means you manage to do so, whether it's with a recurring subscription payment, which will soon allow you access to an exciting and sexy and exclusive club of sorts. It's sexy of sorts, and it's arguably exclusive in the dictionary definition of that phrase. I've been awake for an awfully long time. The boy had night terrors. Oh, God, that's a whole new world to enjoy. So anyway, my point being, thanks for either contributing financially or indeed contributing by sharing the show, rating it, particularly on your podcast app if you're an iTunes user who is outside the UK. I've got something like 850 reviews on iTunes. It'd be nice to make an even 1,000 in the UK, but equally I know the American one, I haven't been pushing for that so hard. So if you're an iTunes listener outside the UK, or if you're on a separate, like an Android podcasting thing, or Stitcher, or Podcast Addict, or Pocket Cast, or any of those ones, just chuck me a friendly and positive comment on there if you fancy, and it just helps to make the show more visible. So thanks for all of that. I will post Amble at you in just a moment if you'd like to hang around for that. But for now, that concludes the podcast. So, Paris, night terrors, Parisian night terrors. The Paris gigs were so much fun. I've got to admit, on the way over there, I was very confidently expecting an English expat audience. More fool me, because why would you need to have an expat community in Paris if you can just literally jump on a train back to the UK? So the gigs that I've done loads of shows abroad all over the world. And when I've done them, they have been one of two types. I now realise they've either been expat communities of largely British people or they've been, you know, Australians and American people, native English language speakers. Or in a few examples, I did a comedy festival in Estonia with the comedy club in Tallinn, and similarly in Maastricht. I forget who books that. It may be a Barnstormers gig. I feel like it was in Maastricht. Had a fabulous road trip with George Egg and Dan Evans, on which we invented a very cruel comedy-based car game. Anyway, the point is, those audiences were entirely one language, Estonian or Dutch, and they all spoke English to a very high degree. One of the shows on the Paris, but I mean, you can't call it a tour if it was two nights, but the Paris double up. One of the shows was to an audience who I didn't know how much English they spoke. Some of them were French and were not expecting an English show. And I was on my back foot to begin with, but I really enjoyed it. I was sort of hastily getting ready, going, okay, let's do all my biggest kind of visual act out stuff, which is a really fun way to prep a set list. That's quite an interesting paradigm to go, what's all my most kind of available to anyone who doesn't speak my language stuff? And that was really fun, but it suddenly took out one of those, I think it was Eddie Izzard who said something about if you take away a comic's opening line and their closer, you really find out who they are. You really find out how funny they are. And I thought, oh my God, this is, in a similar way, this has swept the legs from under me. And in a situation in which I had to prepare very quickly and kind of throw the plan out the window, it was really, really fun. And it made me excited about testing myself in different situations. But yeah, I wonder what other kind of paradigms there are to, reusing the word paradigms, but I'll leave it in, even though I hate myself. I wonder what other ways there are of slicing up your set. What are all my sharp one-liners. I've got one or two. I write about two or three one-liners a year. Maybe by now I've got enough for a four-minute set of just one-liners. That'd be quite an interesting exercise. But so that made me think about that. And the second thing, holy Jesus, night terrors. Was it night terrors? Was it a nightmare? The boy was able to express afterwards a specific thing that he remembered dreaming about. He's been having bad dreams because he's a bright little guy with an overactive imagination. And my wife says she doesn't have nightmares. What? Wait, how can you not have nightmares? So when I say my kid is a bright little guy, what I'm doing is directly drawing a line there between intelligence and nightmares in order to suggest that I'm more intelligent than my straight A star gaining wife. So that's what I'd always assumed, that if you're smart, you have nightmares. My wife is very smart. She claims not to have nightmares, or if she does, they're kind of anxiety dreams. Really? She's never had a huge epic dream where she's been fighting zombies or trapped on a roof or exploring the concept of time itself, which I was awoken from by the night terrors. And if you're interested, time is the shape of a huge white cone with the point skywards. Nothing more tedious than hearing about someone's dreams. But were they night terrors? Was it bad dreams? Does it make any difference in how we treat him? Suddenly, it's a visit to the internet and all of the various terrifying parenting advice sites. But I don't. I mean, I would hate for him to, for this to be a thing he has to go through. Oh, man, we were in an Airbnb in France and the neighbours knocked on the door at like half four in the morning. And we thought, oh, God, they can't be. They're going to complain about it. I mean, he was screaming for 10 or 15 minutes. No. Only they were really nice. And only afterwards did I think, thank God people are nice enough to knock on the door and go, is the child that we can hear screaming no in any danger? So thank you to those anonymous Frenchmen for hitting us up in that fashion. But God, what a just a thing when your kid is fighting you and pushing away and trying to kick away from you and trying to basically jump out of your arms and smash himself on the floor. And God, horrible. I've got no point to make about that other than hoping that he isn't in for a phase of these or a lifetime of these or anything like that. Did you have night terrors? I remember having that thing where what is it? A nightmare is when your mind, your body is asleep, but your mind is awake. This is sounding very pseudoscience already. I had that one where your mind is awake, but your body's asleep and you get really frightened because you can't move. And then you start thinking about breathing and you start thinking that you can't breathe. I've not had it for a while. I hope thinking about it now doesn't cause it again in me or you. But I definitely had those when you're just lying there going, I absolutely cannot move and I feel this weight on my chest. I think some people put that down to ghosts, but not me. I think it's a scary head thing. Ugh. This is. Do you know what this is? This is ghost stories all over again. Ah, free me. Right, that'll do for now. I've got things to be doing, performative things to be doing, which I'm feeling. I'm in a pre-gig state now. I'm on stage in about 10 minutes, and I suspect that by hanging out with some people backstage at this particular show, I have made myself overconfident. So I need to go off, think myself back into a state of, oh, maybe it'll be okay, and then find that excitement back so that I don't walk on all overconfident and completely lose the room. That'll do. Bye for now.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.